everybody. This is Alex Swatz with a long overdue episode of the Indofunctor podcast. We are roughly 1 week away from Monad Mainnet, and I have Mr. Peanut Butter Jelly Time from Purple here with me today. PBJ, what's the root of your initialism, let's call it?
It's just the letters to my name. It was also a hard name for kids to pronounce growing up, so it just kind of worked out. I also like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, so multiple uses for the acronym.
Nice. I as well am a fan of the PB&J. I like the strawberry jam more than the grape, to be clear. I'm a strawberry guy.
Blueberry all the way.
Or is raspberry. That even legal? A raspberry I can get behind. Yeah. Raspberry I can get behind.
Yeah.
Blueberry jam's not.
No, definitely no for grape. Grapes, no.
Yeah, dude, what are you, like five, like eating grape fucking jelly? Like, come on.
Although it is the Monad color, so maybe we should support that.
Fuck, you're right. We need to get the editors on that ASAP.
Take two.
Yeah. So, PBJ, what is your role at Purple?
Yeah, I'm the co-founder of Purple. Purple is a perp stack on Monad. I am also the non-technical co-founder, even though I'm an engineer by trade. I get to do all the not fun stuff. Not that this is not fun. This is a lot of fun, but most of my days, it's just dealing with fires and also at the same time trying to get this product ready and setting unrealistic timelines so everybody hates me, so we can get this thing onto mainnet and get the ball rolling. But yeah.
Do the people who report to you have a heart attack every time they see one of your tweets about a launch date?
Thankfully, I haven't tweeted anything like that out. But I think like a week or two ago when I was on Monad in the morning, I literally just leaked all of our testnet docs and timelines, and Jeeva was panicking in the background. I was like, holy shit, we haven't tweeted anything about this. Everybody to the battleship. So it's a good thing I don't go on many of these to accidentally leak anything.
So I have a very, very deep question for you. And I think this is like the kind of thing where it's like every once in a while you just see just like a moment of such genius that it takes you aback. So you're a perp stacks, okay, doing perpetuals, and you're building on a blockchain, and the blockchain's like, main color is purple. Yep. And so you guys call yourselves perp, P-E-R-P-L. What artist is behind that?
Man, it's honestly a stroke of brilliance, and it was from frustration because we were trying to find first we were like, oh, we should look at like Greek names and like something like fancy and that relates to time and perpetual and whatnot. And
we came had a product something. Called Kairos. Just throwing that out there. Sorry for interrupting.
Exactly.
We did have a product named Kairos. No one calls it that.
I came up like our lab's entity is called Ionix, and it's hard to spell, hard to say. But when we were trying to copyright and get the trademarks and everything, there was some bank somewhere in Europe that had the same thing. And they're like, well, we can't call the product that. And then AC, my co-founder, was just like, well, shit, what about purple? Purple, like perpetual, but remove all like the letters that we don't care about. It's like, oh, wow, that's actually great. It works on like so many different levels. So it was literally like him just being frustrated with like the lawyers and everyone just saying, we can't call it this, we can't call it that. And, great name, worked out in the end. It fits on multiple levels. And in turn with his marketing genius was like perps on purple chain. So, it's awesome. It's actually one of the few times that one of our names actually worked out for us.
I like it a lot. It's like you can look at it and you can know exactly what it is by looking at it,
right?
Which I think is a stroke of genius. It's definitely simple. I do remember when you guys were calling yourselves Aeonix.
And
purple's like way easier to remember.
Right. We took too much inspiration from Monad, Monad, and all the fun that they had with their name. And we're like, we should also pick a name that nobody can say.
Nice. So you said you're the technical, non-technical founder. Like, what was your background before you got into crypto and DeFi?
Yeah, funny story. AC, my co-founder, who's a CTO, both of us, we were FPGA developers. So we basically wrote software for these pieces of hardware that I think most people in crypto know about. A lot of great uses for early days of mining Bitcoin. These days, a lot of like ZK stuff happens on FPGAs. So we worked at one of the two companies that created these FPGAs. And I would say the easiest way of thinking about it is similar to how like Foundry is like this software IDE for Solidity. We were writing a similar type of IDE for other FPGA developers to write VHDL or Verilog and get it compiled on the chip. So we were doing that. AC for a couple of years longer than me. I was kind of frustrated building like dinosaur tech, and this was like 2014, 2015, and all my friends were like working at cool Web2 startup, and just kind of was like pretty disenfranchised with what I was doing, and said, "Oh, we should do a startup." And AC was crazy enough to do it with me, and we quit our jobs in like 2016, 2017. We did a gamut of all kinds of stupid startups. We tried to get into Y Combinator. We did that. We literally at one point thought Silicon Valley, the HBO show, was copying our ideas, because we were like, wow, this is what we're doing. How did you guys figure it out? So yeah, funny enough, like we actually were over engineering in consumer tech, which is like the worst thing you could do, because consumers don't care about any of the fancy engineering you do. Anyway, like long story short, we found ourselves in blockchain through like hackathons. We won a bunch of hackathons. And then we were building on Ethereum and EVM. But yeah, all through this time, we've just been building stuff. And as engineers at heart, we've always been of the mindset of, oh, if you just build it, people will come. Like, we're going to build revolutionary tech and people will just show up to our doorstep.
I can't get over the fact that you were like literally building missiles, and you were like, "Yes, yeah, we were
building missiles." Hold on, we were building these tiny chips that missiles use for guidance, right?
That's really cool.
Accurate. We were just pushing them in the right direction.
I still think that's really cool. I worked at a bank, dude. I was selling bonds to people. That was boring as fuck. But you were you were like, "All right, missiles." Like figuring out how to really like, you know, aim these missiles at bad people.
I would even go, actually,
I really hope.
Let me go a couple of level abstractions higher. Not that. For engineers who were figuring out how to make that more accurate, they were using our chips and we were providing them software to do it. So blood's technically not on our hands. It's on like a bunch of other people's hands.
So basically it was kind of like, you know, all right, missiles, boring. No one thinks missiles or explosions are cool. Give me that 50x leverage. Like that's what will get the blood flowing. That's kind of like the flow.
No. I mean, honestly, like I kind of like stopped at the last part of how we even got to this, but like even this, right? Like it's been like a crazy journey, honestly. And like, I remember when intern or somebody else has asked us like, oh, some, you know, old wisdom, I'm just like, just build cool stuff and good things will happen. And I'm one of the few people that kind of worked for. We weren't looking to build a Perps DEX, but we were building a DEX on Ethereum, which was really cool. Like it was like a paper that Paradigm had put out, and we were trying to productize it because we're like, oh, this is really unique. And this is around, I want to say 2022, 2023. And nobody cared. Again, we were over engineering. The TWAMP paper. So it was just like an on-chain TWAMP with a virtual AMM. So we were building this thing, and then we were talking to market makers, and they're like, listen, man, you have a chicken and egg problem. Only time people want to use like an on-chain TWAMP is when like a DAO or somebody else wants to sell their treasury. And that happens very irregularly. And we're not just going to come market make for one-off situations. It's just too much of an integration. But funny enough, we just met the right people. And one of those market makers were like, hey, how about you come build like a Perp DEX on Monad? Monad's like, obviously, like think a really exciting chain. And it finally has like the throughput and the gas for you guys to do it. You guys know how EVM, you guys are FPGA developers. We can kind of like give you like a little bit of guidance on like perps and we'll figure it out. And it's a great opportunity, right? Obviously, like we'd heard of Monad. And as you're in the crypto space, you know about perps and you know that they're probably like one of three things that have PMF other than stablecoins and block space. We jumped at the opportunity. We were like, yeah, we can come over engineer something that people actually care about. So that's exciting. So yeah, again, a really weird way of finding ourselves here, but you know, it's exciting to be building on like a really hyped chain and a product that people actually care about.
That's really cool. So like with you guys, like the way you describe it kind of makes it sound like, you know, you were kind of led to this. But when I look at like usually when I talk to teams where it's like, you know, someone's like, hey, you should go build this on this chain, they'll usually just like, you know, copy something, you know, like a lot of times dev shops will do that. But you guys are definitely not a dev shop. You guys are the most obsessive, you know, like you guys are hardcore engineers. Yeah. And you guys have gone like so deep into your own code base. And I don't actually like, you're one of the only teams on Monad that hasn't shown me their code base, which drives me insane, as you know, because I ask you this every week. But like it's one of these things where I can tell just from talking to you and from reading your fucking like 90 page white paper that you guys have, you know, spent a lot of time thinking about this and you've spent a lot of time iterating and a lot of time ideating on this subject. So I guess like my question next would be, you know, you have this idea, you're looking at this product type, which is perps, you know, the location, which is Monad. How did you go from that to this like very, very like detailed, very, very like obsessive, like it's very clear that you guys spent a lot of time and a lot of thought on this, like, you know, end product. And I would love to know like how you got from like point A to point B.
Yeah, I think like after we took on the project, it was just a lot of like literature survey. And all through this podcast, when it comes to tech, I'm going to be very generally saying we, but it's actually more AC. So a lot of literature survey, a lot of like talking to market makers, a lot of talking to traders, and really understanding like what is their pain point. So one thing that we did was we realized like, look, if you're going to be building this fully on chain, the one person that you have to be optimizing for is market makers. And the one thing that you need to be optimizing for is their ability to post and cancel orders with the most minimal amount of gas. So that was our kind of like North Star to focus on. And then everything kind of like just waterfalls from that. So that's how we approached the problem. And it was a lot of designing. So AC was initially trying to like design the entire thing in MATLAB, just end to end. And then like 70% of the way he's like, all right, this is stupid. Let me just switch to TypeScript. And then he's like, fuck it, I'm just going to write Solidity, right? So it was an iterative process. So we've been at this since May of 2024, so almost like 18 months. And it is, you literally need to be obsessed with it. You need to be like thinking about this 24/7. It is not a trivial problem. Again, what we're doing is far from like the copy paste. So if you see generally, like when you look at perp dexes, they're in two different flavors. They're either AMMs on these general purpose chains, or they're clobs on an app chain. Again, with the clob on an app chain, you don't care about gas. Like that does not matter to you. You can literally write the dumbest algorithms and you'll be fine. And then if it's an AMM, it's so simple that you can, like GMX kind of did this a couple of years ago. You kind of fork that and paste it in whatever chain. What we're doing is first of its kind, right? It's a fully on-chain EVM club. Everything that we've done is probably going to be like brand new. So like even the way we're done doing funding, right? If you do funding naively, and let's just say you have like 100,000 traders in this market, every hour, 8 hours, when you need to settle that funding, what are you going to do? 100,000 transfers across the world? Like who's going to pay gas for that? Right. It every part of that needs to be thought about, like even the order book. Right. There hasn't been like a really good club on a general purpose chain other than probably Phoenix. they did some really interesting things, but you really can't just copy paste that into EVM because SVM has its own oddities that I'm sure you're aware of. you know, then if you pick the wrong data structure for your order book, then again, that one North Star that I talked about, the post cancels, just completely breaks. So we, again, during that time of survey, figuring out the right data structures, figuring out the right trade-offs, I think we've come to a very unique and probably the most optimal solution that you can get on an EVM. So again, everything that we do, because of our background, comes down to like the 256-bit word size of the EVM. So everything needs to be based on that. There's a ton of bit packing. Like AC literally has like crazy amounts of bit packing. It's funny, I just tweeted out the thing that we weren't aware that the base 256-bit price tree was actually something that Trader Joe had written about, like, I don't know, years ago. And we thought this was patented. So AC was just like, I'll just do it in base 15. Just like went in and like completely rebuilt this thing. And then we're like, wait, this is open source. We could just use base 256. But like everything here is brand new, like done from scratch that hasn't been done on EVM. And it's exciting, man. Like, I can't wait to like put this out there on mainnet. Hopefully it's not going to be at 10 p.m. like the way we release testnet. So whatever that is, it'll be first thing early in the morning.
You mentioned data structure. So I think that's something where it's like, you know, extremely important. You know, we do our fair share of bit packing as well. And I think that it's something that I think a lot of devs do, but I think with what your app type is, the CLOB, the perps, yep, exchange, I feel like it's particularly relevant and particularly difficult even for you guys. And so I'd love to like dive more into not just what your data structure is, but, you know, was that the first thing that you guys tried, and, you know, what you guys discovered along the way, and what that iterative process was like for you?
Yeah, the first thing that we saw was just like, we were just looking for like CLOB structures and like what is like optimal solutions people have tried. There was this, I think there's a code base called QuantCup that was like a doubly linked list data structure that we saw. But the thing that was kind of giving us a lot of problems is just like, how do you like parse this thing in like constant time? So the thing that, the solution that we came up with is just like, there's a lookup of like price indexes, and then there's like a doubly linked list at that price index for the orders in the price level. All that to say, what happens is that lookup is extremely efficient. So it's like a three level 256-bit price tree. So it's basically 256 raised to the third power. And what that gives you is like a very efficient way of finding where the price level that isn't active in 16 million price levels. So why the 16 million price levels matters is, let's say you have a Bitcoin market, right? And in Bitcoin market, you want to market make that in dimes. So 100,000, 10 cents, 100,000, 20 cents, 100,000, 30 cents. If you do that, and if you don't have enough price levels, then you just can't be granular with the way you express your preference, right? So if you have 16 million price levels, you can technically market make Bitcoin from $0 to $1.6 million in dimes, right? And that really matters, because when we were writing this, we're like, we're never going to like, this needs to work for like 5 years without us having to upgrade anything. And we're like, what if Bitcoin gets to like 1.6 billion in that time? It's possible. So that's how we were thinking about it. So that is the data structure that we have, which is like a three-level price tree and a doubly linked list at each price level. And what does that get you? Well, you can do lookup in constant time and insert in constant time, because you're inserting at the end. But matching is linear time. So if each of those orders don't have enough inventory, you just got to keep going. So for example, post cancel is basically constant time, and then matching is linear time. And as I mentioned earlier, computationally you cannot do better than constant time, right? And matching, you have to do linear time, because you just don't know how much inventory there is during during matching. So there are some like things that we put in we might not need, for example, TIFs, like time and force orders. We put that in because we were worried about, for example, like in Solana, it's hard to like land transaction, or it used to be hard. I don't know what it is now right now, but what we didn't want to happen is a market maker is quoting and the chain's not accessible for like, let's say X amount of seconds. And then when they come back online, they get picked off because their quotes are still. So one thing that market makers kept saying is like, hey, it'd be really great if you guys can put in a TIF. And what a TIF in essence is, you put in a, let's say, bid or ask, and you say this is only valid for 2 blocks. So after 2 blocks, if you don't go in and cancel it, it's just invalid and you won't get matched against. That sounds really nice, but it makes things extremely complicated when you're trying to figure out what is the true price of the book, what is the true inventory in the book. So
seems like storage that's floating around too that someone needs to clear out.
Exactly. So cleaning that up. So there's just so many levels of like thought and optimization in here, just in the order book, to make sure that one, it's optimized and gas efficient, and you can, you know, look up things really fast, and also to protect market makers because we don't have cancel priority on Monad.
Sounds like a fault of the MEV layer, to be honest. Screw those guys. let me ask you this though. So like, first of all, I didn't know that you guys had like a 3-layer, basically a bitmap going on for price discovery. I find that interesting because that's exactly how the task manager tracks tasks. We just don't use all 256 bits of each layer for the map. We have like a little bit off to the side for like, you know, progress through, which makes me think maybe we should redesign ours. We need to redesign that part of task manager anyway. Anyway, more importantly, you mentioned that the, like, you know, the TIFs have like a lot of like complexity around like the storage stuff. And I would love to dive more into that. Like, how do they get cleared out inside of your data structure?
Yeah. So another thing that I didn't mention is there's 60 million price levels, but one thing you don't want to do, especially in that linear match, is you have to like traverse price levels all over the place. So one of the other optimizations that we did is we said there's only going to be 65,000, I don't know, some number, basically 256 squared amount of orders available in the order book. Again, the reason for this, it'll make sense down the road, but one of the quirks of the EVM is if you write to a cold storage slot, as in like an empty slot, it costs 20,000 gas. If you delete, you get 5,000 back. So there's a difference of 15,000 there. But if you write to the slot that's already dirty, which is an overwrite, it's only 2,800. So it's a huge gas improvement, right? So we really optimized on that. We say, look, most of the times market makers are quoting in only like a certain price band. So they're not really like quoting like crazy number, like high or super low. So we just got to keep those slots dirty, right? So they're always only like using 2,800 gas instead of paying 20,000 and getting 5,000 refund. And then what we did with that is when we did that, we're like, okay, one of the attack vector that opens up is DDoSing that order book. It's trivial for somebody to go and put like min bids and 65,000 of those on chain and just completely clog the order book. So then we're like, you know what? We should put a deposit. So every time you put in an order, you have to put in a deposit. And if we have to go and cancel it, we'll take the deposit from there. And then we're like, well, what if the deposit's too small? Then we're like, all right, we can iteratively increase that deposit to make it so prohibitive that you're just going to stop and try to DDoS the order book. Same thing with the TIF. One of the things that we did was like, you have to pay that deposit. So when you clear out that TIF, you get that deposit back. So there's a incentive for you to go in and clear it. And if you're not going to clear it and you're sloppy, somebody else can come in and clean it. And then the last point of like permissioned cleaning up the book. So we have an algorithm where we say, let's say the mid price is at 100 and like plus 100 minus 100 to zero. If your orders are like really like stink bids or stink asks, and the 65,000 is getting close to being full, like let's say around 50K orders, we'll just go in and cancel those orders and refund your deposit. Ideally, we don't have to do that, but there's like multiple layers of mitigation to avoid DDoSing the order book, because that is like the biggest thing with a on-chain perp dex is people can do that, and we can't just be like, hey, stop. And because of it being on-chain, Sybil is a big worry, right? You can't just stop one wallet. They're just going to create multiple wallets and go in and do that. So that's how we kind of mitigate those issues.
That's interesting. So with regards to like people who dust the order book, that's interesting that you guys have like a cap number of orders. I find that, so it's kind of like, so I'm going to kind of jump ahead a little bit, but sure. You know, the ADL will also be something that will close out someone's position. But in your case, it's not like, it's not just the ADL that can close out someone's position. It's like if some attacker is like, you know, dusting basically your order book, then you also trigger a similar event.
Is there's the right a key difference here. ADLs are open positions. These are positions that have been filled and have been settled. What I'm talking about are resting limit orders. They haven't been filled, right? So the permission cancel is just canceling that out, and whatever collateral they had to post to put that order in is refunded to them, right? ADL happens when these positions have been matched and they're settled and they're actually in the market, right? The earlier topic was about canceling limit orders. So two completely different systems.
Got it. So let's talk about ADL a little bit, because I would be lying if I said I was a perps expert, as we were talking about before we started recording. So what is the ADL? It's like anti-deleveraging?
Auto-deleveraging. So there's, I'll kind of like step back and talk about the different liquidation mechanisms. So there's multiple levels of liquidation in the protocol. So there's partial liquidation, which is, look, you're just a little bit below MMR, so let's just liquidate you a little bit, get you back in like a healthy level. You can continue.
Well, what's MMR?
A maintenance margin requirement. So IMR is like the initial amount of collateral. MMR is like what you have to maintain. Then there's full liquidation where we're just like, well, we just got to close you up. That could be for example, markets that are like super volatile, where we don't think the price is going to come back or whatever. It could be the discretion of the protocol. The third level of liquidation is a buyback to liquidate or buy to liquidate. And what that is basically, for example, PLP, which will be our vault, will buy positions that are too big to liquidate on the book. And the reason for that is if you liquidate, let's just say like a James Winstall's trade on the book, it's going to cause cascading liquidation. It's going to plummet the price. And then you're going to get other people who shouldn't be liquidated, possibly getting in trouble. So those things, what will happen is generally like the vault will take on that risk and they'll slowly ease off into the book over time instead of doing it in like a single transaction. So those are like the normal cases of liquidation. Now the abnormal cases of liquidations are, there's forced close. Excuse me. Forced close is pretty strange. So assume there's like a new perp market that got spun up. Let's say far down the distant future, people are able to start their own perp markets. And in this perp market, two people matched and there's no resting limit orders. So there's no liquidity in the book. There's no way of them closing out that book order if the price doesn't move. And let's just assume the price is flat. Like this is like a totally meme coin perp market. Nothing's happening. So in most protocols, they'll be just stuck. But what we have, this thing is called a forced close. It's basically like, hey, look, me and Alex are matched. This is going nowhere. Close out our position so we both get liquidated and get out. Most probably should be delisting that perp anyway. Then the next abnormal situation is ADL. ADL is what happens pretty often. The difference between ADL and a liquidation is in a liquidation, only the loser is kicked out. The winner stays and they get matched with another person. In an ADL, both sides get kicked out. Right. So the way the ADL sort algorithm is, highest P&O and highest leverage is matched against like the biggest loser. Both of them get kicked out. So they're kind of just ripped out of the system. And then the last type of liquidation or closing out is called an unwind. And this is what happened probably with Jelly Jelly, from what we can tell, is a market was like manipulated and the price like way off. Everything is like bonkers. And what you do there is you pause the market and you say, all right, this is like the price at which like I think things started going haywire, and then you just get people out at that price in the most fairest way. The difference between an ADL and unwind, in ADL, you're not pausing the market. The market's continuing. Trading's still happening. In an unwind, you've paused the market and you're basically kicking people out. So that those are like six different levels of it, of liquidations or closing out positions. Hopefully that answers kind of like your ADL question.
It does, yeah. Like, let me go back to the beginning of that. So partial liquidations seem optimal for pretty much all parties involved. I guess my question would be, how do you start differentiating between partial liquidations and full liquidations? Like, what's the threshold?
It could be a number of things, right? Like, for example, let's say it's like a blue chip market like Bitcoin or ETH, and you're not worried about price just, you know, being erratic, you could probably partially liquidate. If it's like a meme coin, you're like, oh, I might not be able to like liquidate this person later because it might have gone into like ADL situation because the price crashed too fast. Another reason for partial versus full is, let's say it's a larger position and you don't want to like push that entire liquidation on the book. You'd rather just partially liquidate and keep that position. Now, we've talked to traders who are just like, they kind of go both ways, and there's like, actually, I would much rather you just fully liquidate me, kick me out of the casino. And some people are like, oh, I like partial liquidation. I can continue trading, right? At the end of the day, the decision comes down to what is best for the protocol, solvency. And it really depends on the market and the size of the position and some other factors.
That's interesting. Like, we do a lot of work with lending apps. And so partial liquidations is something that we've studied pretty deeply in the lending app space. And over there, you know, every time you do a liquidation, there's this concept of like a liquidation bonus. Mm-hmm. And the liquidation bonus is basically, you know, one way to think about it is it's collateral that's leaving the lending app and going out to the liquidators or the solvers or searchers, whatever you want to call that entity. And one of the things that we think is like really interesting is that partial liquidations are a great way to keep more collateral inside of the lending app so that the lending app is better collateralized in the event of like a liquidation cascade. The cascades themselves are less likely to happen. But that's like with like lending apps. And so I guess like my question for you is something similar true also in the realm of perps? And if so, like how does that manifest?
Yeah, I mean, I think like having like a higher open interest is always a good thing, right? Like keeping these positions active is good. It shows that there's like people are interested in the market. But our calculus is different than a lending app. It's all about solvency for us, and I guess for a lending app as well. But the difference is in a lending app, you're actually moving that collateral out of the system. So like whatever you borrow is leaving the system. Nothing ever leaves a perp dex. Everything is siloed in. So we just have different risk trade-offs that we have to make.
That's interesting. And it's also interesting to me that like with the lending app side of liquidations, you are typically doing a partial or a full or some ratio based off of the like collateral ratios of the person being liquidated. Liquidatee? I don't know the correct noun for that. But with you guys, it sounds to me like it's more along the lines of like, all right, well, what's this position? You know, like, is it a shit coin or is it Bitcoin? And I find that to be very interesting. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like from the perp protocols perspective, say that five times fast, from the perp protocols perspective, that is like, it's all staying inside of the system anyway, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool. So how, like if there's no like liquidation bonus, like how does the perp protocol make profit?
Yeah. So that's a great question. There's multiple ways of skinning the cat. In our liquidation regime, so the way we think about it is the profits get split three ways. One is the liquidator, one is the person that got liquidated, and the third part of this goes to the insurance fund. So there's three pieces of like whatever collateral or profit that gets split up. So that's how we think about sharing the liquidation bonus. It's not a revenue model. Unfortunately, some perp dexes have made liquidations a revenue model, and that's why they do predatory things like 100x leverage, 1000x leverage, and zero fees, because they're trying to get you liquidated. The way we think about revenue is fees. We think like fees are the most transparent and fair way of doing revenue. And also, again, I think the problem with some of social media and crypto Twitter is like most people that are the loudest aren't the ones that are actually either using the product or building the products. So they just have the completely wrong perspective. So funny kind of side, most protocol builders or people that talk about building perplexes, they just obsess over milliseconds and block speed. But if you talk to market makers, and this isn't like across the board for every market, there's like nuances here, but generally what they care most about is order flow, i.e. like, is there like a lot of like non-toxic order flow in this venue? Second thing that they care about is determinism of like landing the transaction. What would suck is like, there's great order flow, but I don't know how to like land a transaction. Like the chain just doesn't like accept it or whatever. Third one is cancel priority. Can I cancel and get out of the way fast enough? And then last is like block speed, because at the end of the day, everybody's on the same block speed, right? So for them, like if anything, they want to find these like edges and like infrastructure or whatever where they can get in front of somebody. So that's what they care about. It's not like, oh, I'm at market making at 1 nanosecond. That doesn't really move that needle that much. And then again, on the other side of the takers, right? Like everybody's like, oh, it's zero fees. That's all they care about. Not really. They care about like liquidity where they can trade and not get killed on slippage. They care about listings. Like they want to trade the things that they're excited about. They care about user experience again, like not having to like sign every transaction or having transactions that actually like land and not like fail. And of course fees, but then if you look at the fee model of any perpdex, a fee model of perpdex that actually charges fees is the more volume you do, your fees go down to zero anyway, right? So it's not like fees are like already going down. So it's just like the wrong kind of like mindset that people have of like what actually matters to their customers, because they don't either build it or talk to their customers.
So that is very interesting, especially the comment about block time. So let's double click on that real quick. Monad has 400 millisecond block times. It's pretty fast. Same block time as Solana. Solana shreds blocks, but that's not 100% of a guarantee. The validators can kind of play around with that if they want to. But L2s don't. You know, the centralized sequencer chains, if we even call them chains, they say they can get down to 1 millisecond block times. Those block times don't have state roots, and so I don't really view them as blocks. But like that being said, they are relatively fast. And so have you guys noticed any like commentary or any like feedback around your choice to go like the decentralized route? Versus is anyone saying like, well, why don't you just build on, an L2, and this way we can have like our transactions first come first serve or something like that. Like what's been the market feedback?
Yeah. I mean, obviously like it would be great if Monad's block time goes down lower. Right. And I think that's definitely on their roadmap. I think they're starting out pretty conservatively, and I'm pretty sure they'll push it down to 200 or wherever else. But even like Hyperliquid, right. If you look at like early days, they started around 200 milliseconds. They weren't a 70 millisecond block time. Again, the fact that they have cancel priority is really helpful. It's not that block speed. Another thing with the L2 argument is the time when you make the most money or lose the most money is when L2s fail you. And as a market maker, like that is unacceptable for them, where of course they're gonna like, as I mentioned, order flows there, they will be there, but October 10th, every L2 failed, right? And pretty much like the L1 thesis was like validated. Solana, Ethereum, Hyperliquid L1 all operated just fine. You just can't have that happen. And I'm sure most of them would rather like market make on a chain that's not going to have outages when things matter, or when they have to close that position or risk, or buy up all the inventory that's like mispriced. They would much rather like a chain is operating then than like, oh, cool, you have like 10 millisecond block time. Okay.
Why did all the L2s fail? Because I remember like AWS having an outage, but that wasn't the same as October 10th, was it?
No, that was a different one. But like, here's the thing, like Coinbase, Binance, everybody has like great DevOps, I'm sure, but it's still centralized, right? And centralized infrastructure just cannot handle that spike of load. I mean, Lidar even made a comment about this, right? Where they're just like, look, we didn't scale our infrastructure to that. We didn't think it was necessary. But again, fair point to them, right? It's not like every day that October 10th happens. But every single L2 failed because of like the spike in like load. And it could be like the fact that they're all in like, I don't know, AWS, Tokyo, or wherever else they're all like co-located in, right? And it could be an AWS issue, but it's just unfortunate that people just keep kind of trying to like play the same game, even though they know that the story is the same over and over again. And it was a very deliberate choice to build on an L1 because we know how like Ethereum never goes down, right? And Solana, even though it has gone down, they've improved. They've gotten a lot more resilient. And that's the thing with L1s. They're more anti-fragile than L2s.
I agree on that strongly. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, there's also a lot of, you know, regulatory concerns into the differences between the two. One of the things I do note, because you were mentioning Hyperliquid. So Chorus One had this great report where they talked about how, you know, they were under pressure from the Hyperliquid Foundation or whatever that entity is called to have their validator node be running in AWS Tokyo, where all the exchanges are, and how pretty much all the validators are in Tokyo. Meanwhile, the Monad Foundation is like, hey, we really need a validator to be running in Australia and South Africa and Argentina. And like, on one hand, I think that's really cool because the Monad Foundation is for sure all in on geographic decentralization. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure that means we can't get block times like shorter than like 200 milliseconds on like the like very, very low bound, just as like the round trip travel time around Earth. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think that geographic decentralization is, as an objective for the Monad Foundation, is like somewhat at odds with Perps Exchange?
Yeah, but it also kind of like depends on like the stake weight, right? I mean, you can have a node in Australia that's just not going to validate anything or never going to be a leader, right? You have to like educate me here. Like, isn't it based on like how much stake that node has as to how many?
Well, the foundation is giving, like the foundation is, they haven't officially, but like
another,
they are incentivizing stake to these.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if, like, so Australia is a lost cause. Australia's got, like, its own infrastructure problems. Like, sharks eating the cables and, like, you know, dingoes stealing, like, you know, the FPGAs. That's but hilarious. I think that, like, there's definitely a validator in South Africa. There's a few in South America. Yeah. I think we actually run a node in South America, too. But I think that, like, the foundation genuinely is pushing for geographic decentralization, and because the foundation controls such a large percentage of the stakeable float, like I would expect there to be blocks that are created on a not too, you know, rare basis, on a fairly regular basis, from places that are very far away from Tokyo.
Yeah, it's a fair point, and I think that just again goes back to us having like tips, us having like interesting things to like help market makers protect their orders. And it's also one of those things that the market structures and like Monad's infrastructure quirks will kind of resolve itself. And maybe Foundation will realize, hey, Monad's biggest thing is exchanges and we can't really screw them over by having a random like 800 millisecond block. So not too concerned about that. I don't think we're at the scale where that's going to matter to us, but you know, down the line, if we hit that scale and start seeing like, hey, look, for example, like when Uniswap was like 80% of the block space on Ethereum, right? Maybe some of the things that Uniswap is doing matter to Ethereum. So I think Purple right now isn't in the place to be like complaining about those things, but maybe down the road that we become like a ideally, like Hyperliquid perps on Hyperliquid L1, Purple on Monad is that, and start saying, hey guys, you guys are causing a lot of issues here. But I trust like James and Keone. I've put thought in that they're from like HFT. They're from Jump, so it's not like they're just like random guys building a L1.
And I think like one other thing too is that like, so if I put on my old market maker hat, which I was always a mid, you know, never super good at it, but if I put that hat on, I did. It is not hard to get a sense of like the leader schedule. The leader schedule is usually something that's like published. And so it wouldn't really be hard to kind of like build in extra a little bit of like buffer. If you see the Gmonets team coming up, getting ready to make a block, like great, you know, great validator, unfortunate location, but they're doing
it. I guess like they'll just pull the quotes. When Austria is coming up, we have a blackout in like the order books.
Like, or just like, you know, build in a little bit of spread, but like, right, yeah, like do right. something, like do something to offset the extra latency. It is something that's handleable, I think. I actually don't know if there are any in Australia. Australia is just such like the internet's so bad. And it's the sharks, man, sharks literally will eat the cables.
I remember like early days, there was one node in South Africa. And then I remember James saying like he wants one in Antarctica or something. It's just like, don't know, man. Like maybe you have one on the moon as well. Like interplanetary decentralization.
Dude, there's like an L1. It's like its entire basis is like all of the nodes are satellites and stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's, I don't know. I think that like from my perspective, you know, everything that causes you a headache also causes the MEV layer a headache with this kind of thing. But I think as long as the block time doesn't go below round trip time, I think we're okay. Yeah. I think though that like there are a lot of financial incentives where if you are running a node in a weird part of the world, like you're not even going to know it's your block. Order flow is not going to have like that much time to make it to you, you know? And so like you're getting, and we actually put out a paper on this. It's like your revenue is going to be very, very compressed. And, you know, we shared this with like the Monad Foundation because timing games, especially with the validators, is like a huge decentralization risk. And, you know, I think that there are a few different ways to counteract this. One of the way to offset the decreased revenue expectation from just having a really far away node, because like if you're far away, you have to release your own block sooner. So like your cutoff time for orders coming in gets like compressed. And so you're going to hate this. One of the ways that like, you know, the foundation can offset the economic pressures to be far away is to give them more stake so that they have more stake that they're earning fees on so that they mine more blocks in expectation. So interesting to see how this all evolves. While we're on the subject of Monad stuff that makes PBJ happy, you had mentioned earlier with regards to the storage that like, you know, writing a new slot to storage is roughly 20K.
What?
I think that it is the expectation of a lot of people inside of the Monad ecosystem that the cost is going to be going up a lot for that.
I thought they were just, it was a funny troll. Honestly, if it was like April, I'd be like, this is hilarious, guys. Like, yeah, I guess the concern was that it would be trivially DDoSable if it was like 20K write and the read. So it's the S load and S store cost, right? So I think they still made S load. Still a little bit different than Ethereum. I think you probably had it right. I think enough wallets complained that, hey, we are not going to be able to estimate gas if you kind of just like change this a month and a half before mainnet. It's funny enough, like we were probably the only team that was relatively okay because we optimized on the one quirk of the EVM, which is the overwrite costing 2,800, and Monad kept that cost the same. And they made refunds really high as well. So funny enough, like our cancels would actually make you money. But then it would kind of screw over the next person because the slot would be completely cleaned. So it was this interesting proposal, and I'm sure they will try to do it later on. And I think you can look at it two ways, right? Like one, the teams that are building on Mana, like the native teams, this is kind of like the cap and the feather of like, hey, when you say Mana native, it's not like just build on AVM, it's going to completely translate over here, but the opcode pricing is different, so maybe that's not going to work for you. But I don't know. I think like if they find out that maybe the chain will be able to handle the load, and it just gets harder to DDoS it the more blocks it produces, right? So maybe they won't change it. But either way, we were like, one funny thing that happened is like we didn't implement change order in there. So change order is even more optimized than post cancel. So currently post plus cancel costs about 100k gas, which is, to give you perspective, that's like 1 cent.
Very cheap.
That's 1 cent for 10. Yeah.
So that's no, that's like writing over existing storage that's just got like a bit flipped to stay not null.
Exactly. We call it slot warmers. But yeah, so it's 100K gas, and then you can batch about 10 of them post plus cancel in about a cent if Monad is at 10 cents. So, and again, to give you people more perspective, on Ethereum, Uniswap V2 swap, the simplest X equals Y times K, or X times Y equals K,
was roughly 45K gas. It's the router that really screws people over on Uniswap.
Yeah, exactly. So for us, like, in a, like, this is the difference between like a spot dex and a perp dex, right? Like everybody's like club, like a couple of weeks ago or months ago, and I'm just like, is this a spot club or a perps club? Because it's orders of magnitude more complicated than a perps club, because you have to do solvency checks. There's leverage, there's liquidation. So so when you, every time you post an order, you have to make sure that they have the collateral to be able to do that if they have other positions open. Right, so there's just so many checks happening, and the reason I'm saying that is to do that in 100k gas is insane. So then change, for example, is even cheaper. I believe it's 60k gas, and there's three types of changes. One is you can change the price level of your order. So let's say you're quoting at 100k, you can move that to like 101k. You can change the number of lots you're quoting. Let's say you were saying I'm going to sell one lot of Bitcoin, you can change it to two lots. But if you go down in lots, you'll hold the priority in the order, like the price time priority on chain. And then the third one is changing the TIFF. So you can say, all right, instead of this order expiring in two blocks, let's just extend it a couple more blocks to like five blocks. So you can continue extending the TIFF. So there's three types of changes. The reason I'm saying that is like we didn't implement that, but then we panicked that they were changing the gas cost. And we're like, well, we need to give a better option than post cancel. And that came about in literally like 4 days, and that allowed us to like actually collapse the gas cost by even 50%. So we're kind of prepared for anything at this point. So it was actually a fun challenge in hindsight. I'm glad they did it because now we have change. But then they went back on it. So yay.
Well, I think they'll go back again and bring it in. I did, like, we had this similar fire drill where it's like all of a sudden, you know, some things, not everything, but some things cost a lot more. So we basically redid our entire storage structure for the liquid staking token and just switched to like a full on like ring buffer memory layout, which for an LST is kind of weird. But it's just like what we had to do so that we were never, ever writing to a null slot in the hot path for anything MEV related or anything like, you know, transfer related for the LST. So it was fun. It was like a good challenge. It did trigger like the need for an audit again, but it was something where it's like I'm glad we did it, because now we have like a huge leg up over other liquid staking tokens. And so, because like I don't know about your product, but our product category, anyone can copy and paste an LST from like 5 years ago and deploy it on pretty much any EVM blockchain. And so we've never really viewed like the product of LST to be any sort of defensible like product, because any, like, you could make one in like 20 minutes if you wanted to. Anyone could. You could have an AI do it even if you don't know Solidity. And so for us, like, you know, any time there's a chance to do something unique and extra, we really lean into it. And I do kind of view the gas fire drill of, hey, you know, writing to null storage is now going to be 120K. It was like, yeah, it was stressful for sure. You know, we did have to do a lot of work, but that's work that other teams will also have to do if they want to compete with us. So I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Funny enough, right? Like that happened and, it's totally, it'll be good. Like it's a competitive advantage, I think, to have that. And, we'll see how things transpire.
Yeah. I think that like from the Monad Foundation or from the Category Labs perspective, I think this is actually Cat Labs. I think that like from Cat Labs perspective, they really wanted there to just be like a knowable cost of the like writing to null storage so that they could assign like a value to state growth.
Yep.
And, you know, so I got the sense that like, you know, if they don't increase the null storage slot, then they would just increase the minimum base fee to a level where the like actual amount of like Monad tokens paid for taking up an extra slot is something that would like, you know, be scalable. And so like, I kind of get like the rationale and like where they're coming from. Really, it's just like, from our point of view, it's just like an optimization thing, which I think is cool.
But oh, like, that's what I was going to say. When you're talking about the copy pasting, the LLC thing, dude, this code base is insane. It's supposed to be a 6-week audit. It's turning into a 10-week audit. We have like the two best auditors. One of them only speaks math. and they're like, this is by far the most complicated code base, and it has so many sharp edges, like so many economic vectors to attack with. And they're just like, can you close it down a little bit? Can you just make sure that you whitelist people in the beginning, you make it up? It's a funny story. And this is honestly, thinking back on it, it was suicidal. We weren't going to do upgradable. We're like, no, we have to like not make it upgradable. And this auditor's like, please make it upgradable. I know this is like, it's a coming from an auditor. They're like, you guys need to make this upgradable. So it's, I think like when we open source it, I'm sure people will try to copy it if they can understand this Egyptian hieroglyphics that is our code.
We also got hit with the, this is the most complex code we've ever seen for our LST, but like, it wasn't like all of our LST, like most of our LST we had already pre-audited. For us, the part that was complicated was the part that interfaced with the Monad staking precompile, because we wanted to have like a large number of, cause like we, you know, we had like maybe a month, right? And so we wanted to make it so that we had like on-chain robust error handling. It's like what if we stake this amount and it doesn't show up, or like what if we, you know, send MEV rewards? And there were a lot of unexpected things that were happening that we were discovering as we were going. And so there is a lot of complexity in our code, but most of that complexity is around like error handling of the precompile, which is still being updated, I might add. And so I do plan to launch with all of our like bespoke error handling still in the contract. Nice. But that's like a weird thing for a company to do, right? It's like most people don't launch smart contracts with error handling, but like most people are just like, just do it right to begin with. And I think that's in general a good programming practice. But for us, we expect changes. We know there will be changes. Like we know that this is something that'll be like an ongoing thing. And so we wanted to make sure that our accounting is right, even if they change the precompile, and even if like, you know, we're not around to like do like a multi-sig upgrade. Like we wanted to make sure that like our LST reacts correctly, even if, you know, some interest that currently doesn't show up in a number all of a sudden starts showing up in that number, then we can like handle the deviation. And so it is like a very different way of building. Yeah. And it drove our auditors insane.
Was there when you were saying that, I just thought about it, like, was there ever like something that Monad talked about where if certain smart contracts get called very often, it kind of puts in like a hot path and it's just like more gas optimal to call it? I don't think it's a precompile. Like there was some other word that they used for that.
It was like a certain smart contracts that were going to get constantly called. They had like an automatic precompiler. And so I think the idea was that like, it wouldn't like, because like what is a precompile? Like all a precompile is just saying this EVM bytecode is silly because the actual machine instructions are like, you know, different. Like the EVM bytecode translates to EVM, and then EVM translates into like machine. And so what they were saying is basically contracts that get called a lot, such as their staking precompile, but like some contracts might get called a lot. And those, they would just load the actual machine, like keep the actual machine instructions in memory so that it doesn't need to translate from bytecode to EVM and then EVM to machine. It would just kind of skip that middle path. That was my understanding.
Yeah, that's really cool. I wonder if anybody else does that. But it's just like, I think when people talk about Monad, they're like, oh, like, is it the parallel execution or whatever? I'm like, no, it's all these like little things that you don't think about that they're doing that is really going to be a killer benefit. But yeah, let's see how that works out.
Yeah, I think on Solana, that kind of thing isn't necessary because it's all already like in the same thing. I think that's like one of the optimizations of Solana. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people are like, oh, the Monad team has to like take this big performance hit because they're using the EVM and the EVM slow. And it's like, all right, well, they're just like, screw you guys. We're just going to auto precompile stuff into machine code. I think that's kind of cool. Like the Monad team, Category Labs in particular, is just like so good at proving people wrong with like, you know, all the limitations. And I've been impressed.
Yeah, but like, this is something that I probably should know, but like the SVM, that quirk of like knowing accounts beforehand is also kind of a pain point, right? Like, how do you do matching runtime if you need to know accounts at compile time, right? Like, you kind of have to have that. That's what the Phoenix design was, right? They kind of almost had this like slush one in between that you would like get matched later, or else you have to crank. So that thing, that's an interesting problem that SVM has. Like, how do you solve that for building like an on-chain club? But now it's funny, like, because of those limitations or maybe something else that I'm not aware of, now there's like all these prop AMMs that pop up, right? Because they're like, well, you know what? Let's just bypass clubs completely and just go to prop AMMs. So trade-offs everywhere. I still think like for on-chain matching, EVM makes more sense.
For sure. And like the other thing too, is that like you could still have SVM without the access lists that are like the requirement. Because like the access lists are really more like a sequencer tool. They have a different word for it, like the scheduler. But like technically, I don't think that has anything to do with like the raw SVM. As far as I understand it, I'm not an expert. But like you do bring up a very good point, which is composability. You know, an access list inside of the SVM, you basically have to already know what your transaction is going to do before you send it in, which means you can't figure out like at runtime what your transaction is going to do. But you guys don't have that problem. You guys could have, you know, a user traverse, you know, one order, five orders, like arbitrary, you know, outcome that's discovered at runtime. And I think that that's like really cool, not just from a execution outcome point of view, but also potentially from a composability point of view. I mean, it's like, you know, you can kind of figure it out in real time, which means you could then do something with it in real time.
Yep.
You know, on one hand, I think the EVM does have a lot of composability that the SVM doesn't have. But with perps, like there's no actual, like if I'm like 5x long PBJ coin, there's no actual PBJ coin inside of the perps exchange for me to then like, if I make, you know, money or if I'm closing out an order, to then like compose with or anything like that. So how do you guys look at composability for a perps exchange?
Yeah, great point. I think composability is, there is advantages to it, but only to a certain point if you're using like USDC as collateral. So the bare minimum composability is, let's say you have a lending protocol on Monad, let's use Euler, for example. And day one, Monad launches, a bunch of people have Monad, a token, and what they can do is park it in Euler, borrow USDC, have that deposited into Purple, and start trading perps with it, right? So that's like the most easy level of composability for you. Another layer of composability is a SpotDex has a coin that's listed, that's not listed anywhere else. So you need an Oracle from that SpotDex to use that in a perp dex, right? So those are like two really nice, understandable things of composability. But really, I think the true unlock from composability that we want to go into is using other collaterals than USDC. I think, for example, today on Hyperliquid, it's USDC. Pretty much like every Park DEX that you see out there is all USDC based. But if you look at the FDV of USDC, or like circulating supply of USDC, USDT versus like Bitcoin, Staked ETH, maybe even Mon and Solana, there's just a lot more collateral there to be used. And I think that's going to be interesting for us to like lean into. Obviously, we're not going to, we're being very careful about the way we introduce that. So the basic level of that we want to try to like get out there next release is this 1x short idea, where if you have Mon as collateral and you come into our perp decks, the only trade you can put on with that Mon collateral is a 1x short Mon, where it's 1x short the perp leg, and the Mon collateral is your long side of the trade. It's basically your vanilla basis trade, where you're coming in, you're hedging your exposure, and if funding is positive, you're collecting funding. So for example, with these LSTs, you could probably come do the same thing, where if you have staked Mon, you come in, use that as collateral, and you short the Mon perp, and you collect funding if it's positive, and also the staking yield. That would be a huge unlock. I think that obviously helps you guys with some of the yield products that you'll offer. It helps us onboard new users. So imagine like Monad in like a year or two is like flourishing ecosystem. There's really cool apps launching their tokens. Today, all those people are either dumping it for USDC or parking in a lending protocol, or maybe putting in like a AMM to earn some sort of yield. What we're offering is a completely new avenue for them to earn yield, which is the basis trade, where they would just take that airdrop, provide the ass side of liquidity on our perp decks, and potentially collect funding if people are interested in that coin. So that is a unique thing that is possible, will be possible in Purple, that I think is where composability really unlocks, which is a collateral side of things.
That's very interesting. So this would be like, so for us, it would be like if we as an LST are doing like a levered loop kind of thing, we could do our final loop by like dropping off the LST over in Purple and picking up some funding at the very tail end.
Yeah. And I mean, today, if you did this on a lending protocol, they're probably going to give you like an LTV somewhere between like 60 to 80 at the top end. And then
they better give us more.
Is it more?
I think initially it will be. I think that LSTs in general, you know, really the main risk is smart contract risk. And so I think that like, you know, once the contracts are battle hard.
Yeah, well, like Euler and Morpho, I think they top out at like 85% on staked ETH. So I'm assuming like newer tokens will be lower. But the point I was getting to is like you're losing about 15 to 20% there of your LTV. And then you come in, you can hedge some of that. What we're offering is basically composing the margin risk engine of the perp and the collateral risk engine of a lending protocol inside the same thing. So where you're able to, the perp is going to be smart enough to say, hey, Alex's position, the underlying collateral offsets the risk of the short perp leg. So it's pretty much like delta neutral. Obviously, if there's some sort of like LTV shaving that we have to do to protect the protocol, or if funding is like drastically negative for long periods of time, that's where a partial liquidation would come in, where we would kind of like bring you back to like a reasonable range. But most of the time, you should be fine. And as long as funding is positive, you're going to continue collecting funding. Like a great example of this is Stake Kaido, or any of these like products that have like future airdrops for staking. You could do that without having to like deal with the price fluctuations of Kaido. You basically do this basis trade, and then every future airdrop you continue to collect it because you still are holding that staked Kaido collateral.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Let me, speaking of like esoteric tokens, what is like the listing process to get a token listed on Purple? Like, are you guys just allowing anyone to list? Is it kind of like Hyperliquid where you have to post a certain amount of like stake in order to list, or how does one get listed? Because you had mentioned earlier that like one of the things people want is the ability to quickly trade like, you know, random new coins that have popped up. And I think that's a very, very like accurate statement. I would love to learn more about the listing process.
Yeah, I think initially it's going to be gated by us, and then eventually we like the Hyperliquid model of, you know, the HIP-3 model, where if you stake enough purple token, you can do this in case you're a bad actor. The thing that we have to be worried about here is, one, that there's actually interest in the market, and two, this isn't an AMM. You can't just expect to have that liquidity just sit there. You need market makers to actually make the markets for you. There's gas involved, so it has to be like a token that's actually like people really want to trade and want to list. So a lot of that will be driven by market makers that are like, hey, like, we are going to market make this token, can you list it? And we have enough trading interest in this perp for us to list it. And that's generally how it works on any of these perp decks, like a WinRMU or a GSR or whatever. Who's working with that team of that token will be like, hey, we will market make this on these multiple DEXs or central exchanges. And that's how that flywheel generally starts.
But do market makers ever journey into the realm of like meme coins for market making?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember being in this market making desk and they were like, peanuts running. We need to be more peanut collateral. So I've seen it all, man. Like during the meme coin craze, they were, again, this was spot, right? Not necessarily perps always. I think for spot, they're a lot quicker. For perps, you really need to hit some thresholds where it makes sense for people to actually market make. And again, the market maker needs to get some sort of collateral loan for them to hedge their exposure as well. Because like if they're going to be providing liquidity, they need to be delta neutral somewhere. And if it's like a first listing, they're not going to have another exchange to like hedge their positions with. So they necessarily need that spot token. So again, it comes back to that team working with the market maker as well, the token team, to get that perp listed on the exchange.
That's interesting. Because I think that like it is tough to get that initial liquidity, that like loan from the team for a shitcoin that comes off of like a meme coin launchpad, unless the meme coin launchpad were to be owned by Perps Exchange and you would have it natively on your own books. That would be very interesting, actually. Future possible idea for Purple.
Please give me your pretty bearish on meme coins, if I'm being honest. I think it was a craze, like the NFT craze. I don't know if it's going to continue that way, but you know, that's the benefit of eventually heading in that HIP-3 direction, where you kind of let these markets and trader interests kind of like let that dictate it. And hey, if you want to list these coins, then get yourself a market maker and enough interest. And, you know, we're providing infrastructure at that point.
I also embarrassingly have never bought a meme coin in my life. I have owned some Doge, but that was from back when if you traded on FTX, you got a little bit of Doge each time. Just to date myself. Yeah, this was like way back in like 2020. And they were just giving it away. And I, of course, sold all of it. But there's like parts of DeFi that I am trying to get more exposure to. NFTs is another one where actually I do own NFTs now, but like a year ago, I hadn't. And then Fastlane started doing this campaign with like a lot of these NFT companies on Monad. And I had completely overlooked like that entire segment. And then I start talking to like some of these like groups, and like the Monad Foundation loves NFTs. And so it was like one of these things where, you know, I'm trying to like learn a lot about it. And like with MemeCoin and MemeCoin launchpads too, I feel like there's a lot of, not just meme coins, but a lot of launchpads these days. And so it's like something where like for us, you know, it's hard to know exactly what to pay attention to if you don't just like, you know, roll up your sleeves and mess around with it. So meme coins are definitely on my list. I know I'm going to lose money when I do it. Like, I know I'm going to get screwed. I'm a pretty decent, like, you know, quantitative trader. I'm terrible at just like eyeballing it with like a screen and a mouse and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's hard, man. I think like one of the people I talked to, he was saying like he pays very close attention to TikTok. And if it's taking off on TikTok, he buys a meme coin. I'm just like, okay, none of this sounds appealing to me, but you know, to each their own. I think like Yeah, NFTs are interesting. There's some like good NFT projects. Shout out Benja from Chog and Tequila, who are doing some like really cool things. We'll see. You know, that's the beautiful part about launching a L1. There's going to be a lot of like experiments, and the next pumped-up fund could be on Monad, but I don't think it's going to be the exact same thing. It's going to be something totally different.
Agreed. Speaking of launching, I mean, we are 1 week away, technically 9 days away. What are you guys spending most of your time on right now as you're preparing for day one?
Yeah, we were pretty late to launch our testnet. So we launched that earlier this week. So we got some initial user testing. So we are also having a tournament next week. So we're trying to get as many people trying to break the system, in essence, and finishing up our audit, making sure that we're good there. So we have a bunch of fixes there that we need to apply, and just hardening our systems. So getting ready for mainnet, hardening our systems. Unfortunately, we're not going to be ready for day one of mainnet, but we will be ready for like a few weeks after mainnet. Hopefully the hype is still going. But for us, it's a marathon, not a sprint. We're trying to build this for the next 10 years. And, you know, just being there on day one and not being confident in the security of our system is a lot more risky for us in the long term. And we want to make sure that we're good with our audit, good with our backend system. And even when we roll out, we're going to be very conservative. We're going to have like reasonable open interest caps. We're not going to list every coin that you see out there, probably just like Bitcoin, ETH, and Monad. And as we feel comfortable with the protocol, the chain, the liquidation system, the margin system, that's when we start increasing the caps, increasing the open interest, and potentially listing some of these mid majors.
So this is like a very interesting subject, which is not going live on day one. So there's this like common belief, especially among venture capital teams, where they're just incredulous that it's like, all right, so Monad took like, and they usually have that look on the face, like, all right, so Monad took, you know, 2 years to get to mainnet. Mm-hmm. Why aren't you ready? And, you know, it's one of these things where like, dude, we are ready, but like our wiggle room is like mm-hmm. If they launched today, we would not be ready. Like the audit is done yesterday, and like we are like going through and like reviewing everything, but it's like we were really close. And I think like a lot of the, especially the venture teams, they didn't really understand that a lot of the stuff that we had critical dependencies on, like, yeah, Monad might have been working for like 2 years or 5 years or however long, like on a lot of this stuff. But a lot of the mm-hmm. stuff that we had dependencies on, we've only been able to like iterate on for 3 months now, 2.5 mm-hmm. maybe. And I think like, you know, you guys in a similar boat, like you guys got caught off guard at the exact same time as us when it came to the storage structure, mm-hmm. like rewrites. And so like, I guess like my question for you is like, how's the reaction been from not just your, you know, your investors, but just the market in general about the fact that you guys won't be live on day one?
The investors are pretty supportive, right? Like they realize that we're building something that's, again, not been done before. And it's not just a simple copy pasta. So it's not just like taking some code, forking it and changing the name on it. So they realize, and we keep them pretty up to date on like what we're up to. I think from the community, again, like, our community lead, G-Van and the mods, they've been doing an incredible job of like keeping these people interested and also showcasing like, hey, similar to Monad, good things take time. And when it comes out, it's going to be worth it. So yeah, it might not be ready day one, but again, we are trying to build this community around like resilience and thinking long-term and not necessarily like short-term things. So that's fine by us. Obviously, like if you were like a year delayed, that would have been a lot more stressful. But a week here or there, especially going into like holiday season, I don't think is going to be like that major. So we know exactly what we have in this version. We know exactly what we want to build in the next version. We have like our roadmap and exciting product and features ready. So that's not necessarily a top of mind for us.
Yeah, I've I've heard, like, especially from some venture teams, I've heard them make comments about, I can't believe they're not live on day one. And it's like, shut up. You have no idea what it's like. Just shut up.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think you guys are doing the right thing. I can't stress that enough. You mentioned, though, that you've got some ideas for some features for V2. I would love to learn more about this alpha, you know, this stuff coming down the pipeline.
Yeah, I think like the 1x collateral was one of them. And then the other one I just posted about earlier, maybe yesterday or the day before, which is a hybrid margin. So I think one of the things that you probably, like, the community and like traders have seen with like the 10-10 collapse is there's this kind of disconnect between what traders expect the protocol to do and what the protocol does. At the end of the day, the protocol only cares about its own solvency and not necessarily your trade hedge. So what happened on 10-10 is a lot of these advanced traders put on these long short trade strategies where they'll be long one asset and short another asset. And when prices were collapsing, the short got pulled out by ADL because they were massively in profit. But then the long was left naked. And then when prices were recovering or whatever, the longs got closed out and they got liquidated as well. And so there was this massive confusion happening. They're like, hey, why didn't you close out my long when the short was ADL? And the problem is maybe the long didn't meet that MMR requirement. You can't just arbitrarily go out and close positions that are still healthy at that time. So that was something that we saw. And the issue that we think is because the protocol, in protocol cross margining, where it just nets your P&L of different positions, is too naive to understand these hedges. So a way of thinking about it is every perp dex out there today does like cross market P&L or accounting, like cross margin. But when it comes to ADL or risk, it just looks at that individual market, isolated risk. So when it comes to ADL, it's like, all right, your short position's gone because it's too much leverage. It doesn't pay attention to that long position. What we have on today when we're launching is isolated margin. So your positions are never netted against different markets. So it's a little bit more capital inefficient because you have to bring margin for every position. What we want to go towards is hybrid margin. And what happens there is we look at your risk across markets before we give you margin to move it to that market. And we make that process manual. So let's just say you have, you're long with Bitcoin, right? And you have, let's say, 50K in profits. You want to open up an ETH position. If it was like cross margin, they would just let you use that 50K in profit. What we want to do is have some sort of like a covariance information based on like how these assets move together post to the chain, like at a certain period of time, like a chaos oracle type of thing, like a risk oracle that posts these metrics. And based on that, the protocol will say, cool, your 50K really is not going to be used completely one-to-one on your ETH position. We'll give you 35K based on like how we think those two assets interplay, Bitcoin and ETH. And you manually move that over and open up that ETH position. The reason this is helpful for these advanced traders is they are managing their positions, their risk themselves, instead of assuming the protocol is netting it and managing the portfolio. So when we do come to ADL, right, you're getting ADL based on the cross asset risk. So we'll be like, okay, this person needs to get ADL because this position isn't like properly hedged and it's actually risky to the protocol. It's still like a concept that we're going through and figuring out like how to like really, you know, expose the capital efficiencies of cross margin, but also the risk mitigation of isolated margin in the best way possible. So that's something that might be like later down the road, but we feel like if we do that, it's not that people won't get ADL'd, it's more predictable of like where you will be ADL'd. You will know, okay, this is how the risk engine thinks about my position, and I should get ADL or I shouldn't get ADL, versus being surprised that the risk engine didn't realize that I was hedged.
That's very interesting to me. I think that like you know, like a covariance matrix or like something along those lines to upload in is one of those features that I've heard people say the SVM is better at than the EVM. I think that like part the trader part of me is like, that sounds like a really good thing for a market maker to do. The cash flow part of me though is like wondering like, would that potentially lead to bad debt? So like I guess like in this case, the covariance, like the risk matrix, let's just call it a risk matrix.
Sure.
It wouldn't be meant for determining like when the ADL happens. It would be more like who the ADL happens to, so that that way you're still like always balanced.
Yeah. And also you need to check that when you're opening a position and when you're checking for liquidation. So IMR and MMR is when you need to check the covariance matrix. So at MMR, we're like, okay, this person actually has the margin across these positions, so they don't necessarily need to be removed from this. But then there might be positions that are like completely just like one, basically one position in the market, and they're not really hedged, and they're actually risky to the protocol. They might get pulled out earlier. Another thing that we want to do is we actually want to have like the ADL indicator on the UX itself. And I think some of these central exchanges actually do this, where they're like, this is where you are in the ADL queue. Like your positions are pretty risky. Either realize some profit or close out some of these positions, or else you might get ADL'd. So again, leading more into that predictability of it, because you see the covariance matrix being posted to the chain. You see the risk that you have on your positions, and you also see the position you are in the potential ADL queue.
Got it. That makes sense. So it's less about like the protocol has less risk thing, because the protocol would still have the same risk either way.
Yes.
It's more about like this one person is like long 100x here and has no offsets. They're right. Getting ADL first, whereas someone that's got like some elaborate hedge, it's like saying like, okay, well their net exposure is this, and so like you know they might you know eventually get ADL, but they would be lower on like the ADL priority.
Yeah, and I don't want to like overuse ADL, because ADL should literally be the last thing that the protocol does. So another thing that we're differentiating on is like each market has its own insurance fund, right? So the first you go into the insurance fund to pay out the winner instead of like ADL. Like you might ADL them, but you still pay them out for like how much they were supposed to make. Then there might be like an overflow insurance fund as well. So there should be like multiple layers of security for the trader to be like, okay, if I put on this size, will I actually realize my profit, or will the protocol that has zero insurance fund, zero overflow, zero care for the risk that's actually hedged, just gonna yank me out of my positions, right? So a lot of these like funds and whatnot that we're probably still seeing like bodies of are coming out where they just completely got, you know, taken out of the system because their hedged positions were blown out because of market volatility crashing and coming back up, and they got liquidated on both sides, and even though they were technically trying to do the right thing.
So would the covariance approach actually fix that, or would it just make it less likely to happen? I guess like let me ask you this, just hypothetically speaking, what about a button that someone could click, or like in the front end that goes to the smart contract, which says if you liquidate this, also liquidate this, or like something along those lines. Or not liquidate, but like you know what I mean. If you close out this, then also close out this.
It's not that the covariance matrix like stops ADL. It's just like it makes it more predictable of where you are to be ADL'd, right? Instead of you assuming this naive cross margin netting is protecting you, this is you taking more control of moving your margin yourself and realizing that, hey, if we have to close out this position, it's because of your risk in this position, not because your risk was contaminated across like these different markets. So we're not saying that ADLs won't happen. We're just saying that you will know why you got ADL way before, and it will try to do the best possible where the insurance fund, the overflow, we will try to do our best to make sure to like not ADL you if you're doing the right things.
Got it. And so the reason why, because like you'd mentioned before, and I didn't even know this was happening until you brought it up, but you'd mentioned before that like people would get ADL'd on like one leg and then they would still have the other leg, which would then like, you know, cause them to lose money, and then they would get liquidated. Yep. And they'd be like, what the fuck? I'd be very upset if that happened to me. Cause I didn't know that until you just told me that right now. And yeah. It shows how much I know, but I guess like the reason why you wouldn't want to close out both positions at the same time for you at like a protocol level is because that would cause like the like most like bizarrely cascading
It's also breaking the invariance that the trader knows, right? So like, why are you closing out my position, which is not below MMR, right? Like the protocol has invariants that have to be followed. It can't just be like one-off cases, be like, oh, I closed out his short, but his long is still has the margin, but I still close it up because I close that short. That's just doesn't make sense. It's just too much logic for a smart contract to like dumbly follow. So most of the time cross margin will work, like 80-90% of the time cross margin will work, but that black swan events where traders make most money or lose most money will fail. And that's
they'll be glued to their computers during those events anyway, I think.
And the benefit of this is like if we can isolate each market to itself, like what I'm talking about, but keep the risk across market, you can do these collateral experiments like, hey, let me use my Bitcoin to go long on this new listing because that is isolated to that market itself and you're bringing margin for that market. You're not like contaminating that margin across market. So we think that if you go purely cross margin, it's hard to do cross margin plus cross collateral. But if you do something like a hybrid margin where you're leaving the margin management to the trader, it is probably more reasonable for us to hit that cross collateral product feature, which is maybe Bitcoin ETH can be used to go long on a different token versus like USDC.
Very interesting. Very, very. I that makes a lot of sense to me. I really like this design a lot. Well, dude, Mr. PBJ, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast, the Indofunctor podcast. So this is the first episode we've recorded in a while because we've been like heads down, you know, in my company, like, you know, working. I know that yep. You have been too. And I really appreciate you taking the time to, you know, spend it with us so close to mainnet launch. And while I know that you guys are like really busy shipping, is there anything that the listeners should be looking out for in the very near future? Anything that, you know, they might be able to take advantage of, let's say, when it comes to your own product?
Yeah. Go try out the product. It's at testnet.purple.xyz. We have a huge tournament coming up next week. Lots of fun prizes for you to win. We're also
including your car. Is that correct? Your car?
My car in whichever country we can find my car in. This is all G-Man's like big brain ideas. Marketing is not my forte. It's all his great ideas. So we're also open sourcing our market making SDKs. So if you like Rust and want to write some like market maker bots, we have that. We also have some example maker ticker bots that you guys can play around with. But if you're watching this episode post December, go try out the product at app.purple.xyz. I'm sure it'll be live by then, I hope. And, you know, look forward to seeing you guys on chain.
Oh, yeah. Well, PBJ, thank you so much for coming on. And thank you, everybody, for listening. See you next time.
Thank you.